Hey, listeners, please support the Business of Pharmacy podcast by checking out our sponsors at bizoffarmpod.com. That link is in the description. You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Navid, for those who haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and tell our listeners what we're talking about today.
My name is Navid Alipour. I am co-founder and CEO of AI Med Global, which is our DBA name for the two companies under this umbrella, CureMetrics and CureMatch. On the CureMetrics side, it's a diagnostic we developed to detect breast cancer and heart disease from the same mammogram. On the CureMatch side, what we do there is recommend the best combination of drugs for each patient's specific cancer using our AI.
I don't know if you've seen on the internet, it's been out the last couple years, about the factorial of a deck of playing cards. You take 52 cards and there's never been a shuffle that looks the same.
Right.
And they talk about if you were to shuffle the cards once every 5 seconds, take a step around the equator. And once you did that, you took a drop of water out of the Pacific Ocean and then had a bird go to Mount Everest and peck on that. And after all that goes down to zero, the dry Pacific and the mountains come down, then you're only 1/1,000,000,000th of the way there. So it's just this crazy number. And I imagine that cancer medicines are kind of like that too. There's kind of this factorial going, and once you put two in there, then you've doubled that and then quadrupled and exponentially problems and stuff. And I imagine there's so many different combinations. And I think that's where the AI comes in a bit, right?
Mike, you nailed it on the head there. So if a doctor wants to recommend a three-drug combination, there's literally over 4.5 million combinations. So it's beyond human cognition to process that many, right? And so that's where our KR AI, which stands for Knowledge Representation and Reasoning AI, the differentiation between that and NLP, natural language processing and machine learning that more people have heard of, but that's where that comes in. And cancer, like a fingerprint, like two snowflakes, they never look the same. And so that's where what we do at CureMatch, in short, is, again, we're digital health. We don't touch the physical sample. We don't have a wet lab. We take that input from the labs that do the next generation sequencing, and we get that PDF, that 30, 31 page PDF, or the doctor's office can enter it in our private site. And that next gen sequencing to the layperson, I'd say it's like the 23andMe of that patient's specific count cancer down to the molecular profile. And so we base our report then based on that specific patient's cancer, that no two cancers are ever the same. And so that's true precision medicine, right? And that's what we, in short, do. In fact, I'm very excited to share with your audience that the American Medical Association found out about us last year and encouraged us to apply for our CPT code with them, because as it is, roughly 40% of cancer patients are already getting off-label use treatments, and that percentage is only going to go up. It's not going to go down. And so we submitted for our CPT code, went through that process in front of the pathology caucus, in front of the AMA, and very excited to share that we got it. And so on January 1st, the AMA announced companies that got their CPT codes, and we were one of those companies. It's the first of its kind, in fact, in this category, providing this augmentative intelligence to the oncologist. Again, not replacing. There's the robots and AI aren't taking over, in my opinion, anytime soon, especially in healthcare. And so, but we do say that the AI is not going to replace the doctor, but the doctor using it will replace the doctor that is not.
I'm a rough audience, Navid, because you hear of cancer killing all these people over the years.
Right.
And then you hear about the success of cancer treatment now. And I'm thinking all the talent that's out there and all this stuff. And then when I hear, though, of someone dying of cancer still, like that started in their prostate or something, as my dad started in prostate, went to all the bone. And I'm like, really? People are still dying of that? You know, it seems so simple.
Yeah.
And it's not, but I'm so gung-ho about the future of the medicine that I'm always surprised when someone just gets ravaged by cancer.
Yeah.
And I know it's going fast, but we've got a ways to go still.
We do. We do. And like you, I'm a glass half full guy, or we couldn't do what we do. It'd be too depressing, right?
Yeah.
And we've advanced incredibly. My wife's a Hodgkin's lymphoma survivor, going on 20 years, knock on wood. And Hodgkin's is a very survivable cancer, like prostate, like breast cancer. If you catch it early enough, we all know early detection is crucial. However, people still die from breast cancer, from prostate, from Hodgkin's that are very curable. Unlike some cancers that like ovarian that gets detected very late and pancreatic and kidney that are much, you know, mortality rate is significantly higher. But even with these cancers that are more treatable, one, it's all about as early detection as possible. And two, some of these cancers that are just much nastier, right? They have more variants. And the more variants you have, whether it's a prostate or breast cancer, that to stick with those two, the more variants, the more pathways for the cancer to get away and metastasize and spread, right? And so you have to think of it, and I like my analogies, if you're trying to block water going down a river, the higher up you block it, the higher odds of success, right? Whereas if it's lower, the water will find ways to spread. Or traffic on a highway, if you block it high up, you're more successful. Whereas if you block it later, lower down, there's more on-ramps and off-ramps for the cars to exit and get away, right? And so that's where what we do as CureMatch is to recommend, based on the cancer patient's specific NGS panel, and we're agnostic, by the way, is that from Foundation Medicine, which Roche bought for a couple billion, is it public companies like Guardant or Caris or Invitae or LabCorp? We're agnostic, right? And so we get that input from them, or whether they send it, the oncologist sends it, the patient sends it, and we'll recommend then based on that patient-specific cancer. Now, sometimes we're incredibly useful when it's a nastier cancer, there's more variants, there's more pathways, because then that's even harder for, the human cognition of so many combinations. And in some cases where there aren't as many variants, we're still useful. We'll just validate that the existing standard of care is the best one to go with. But it's sad but true that the law is always behind technology in any industry, whether it's healthcare, whether it's with cryptocurrency, right? The law is always going to play catch up to technology. And so that's where a lot of oncologists, a lot of healthcare professionals, they're going to go with this existing standard of care. And they have that legal air cover to do that, right? They're not going to get sued if you give a lung cancer patient the NCCN guideline standard of care, because even if 98% of them pass within 2-3 years, and if it doesn't work, then they'll look at more cutting edge technologies like us. Now, I think with the CPT code, that now gives that validation for oncologists. Say, look, they got this. They had oncologists from top institutions like MD Anderson and Morse and John Hopkins that sent their letters of support saying CureMatch has changed my therapy decisions. So there's something there. The validation is there. So where the industry is going to go is, I think, instead of us being used when nothing else is working and sure, let's just try it, do it immediately. Patient gets diagnosed. It's the worst news they've arguably ever gotten in their life. They get that biopsy sent to a lab. It gets sequenced. Then get that to us to then recommend some combination therapy treatments out of the gate before anything is administered. And that's where we're going to be saving and prolonging more lives.
I've known so many guys, and I guess gals too, but they say, I was on the treadmill for my stress test and the doctor said, you're not going home for lunch. You're going to take your next step into this hospital bed and have your surgery done to replace all your heart pipes, you know, and that. And it's like, I'm always thinking, it'll be a great day when you don't wait for your first pain to hop on maybe the treadmill, where they're finding these things earlier. But I guess they're costly to do stress tests and all that kind of stuff. And I guess with your stuff, it's probably the same thing. Once you can depend on them more and then the costs are in line and all that, and the CPT code comes in, once all that lines up, then that all equals earlier, and earlier means more helpful.
No, I think that's very accurate. And that's where, again, to prolong lives and save lives, and what you touched on earlier, that why are so many people still dying from cancer? It's going to be the case for some time that cancer and heart disease are the top two causes of mortality at a global level, right? And so to make cancer something like diabetes or HIV, that it's not a death sentence as much anymore, but it's something people live with for decades. And so that's the goal, is to try to make cancer something that is not a death sentence. And it's something that we can either beat or prolong lives. As the oncologists say, increase the PFS and the OS, a progression-free survival and overall survival. So yes, there's treatment decision support that what we do on the CureMatch side. What we do at CureMetrics, which again, these are two separate Delaware C Corp companies. We started them at separate times. On the CureMetrics side, it's specifically our women's health suite of products where we detect breast cancer and heart disease from the same mammogram. And so that's where that's our input. The mammogram is our input. We're digital health. Again, we don't make the physical device. We're agnostic as to whether it's a GE machine or a Hologic machine, but we're arguably the best technology out there in detecting breast cancer from a mammogram. And what we do that no one else does is also detect and score the breast arterial calcification in the arteries of the breast tissue. And so that is early onset of heart disease. So this is something that for us men, as we get older, we'll have symptoms of heart disease, we'll have chest pain, shortness of breath. You go to your doctor, they tell you how bad you've been eating and not exercising and do the EKG and stress test and get you on statins and other medications. So hopefully it's not the surgery, at least that's delayed, or if not immediately, in your example of going straight to the surgery center. Just getting on that statin alone reduces the risk of a cardiac event by 50-60%. Now, with women, heart attack is called the silent killer because 65% die on that first heart attack completely asymptomatic. No chest pain, no shortness of breath. Fatigue, for example, fatigue is a symptom of heart disease, a heart attack coming for women, but it's obviously misdiagnosed. Like, right? And so that's where if a woman goes in for her first mammogram at the age of, let's say, 40, 42, she's not a super athlete, but she's in decent shape. She eats decent. She doesn't have any known heart disease in the family. She's going in for a mammogram. And if we detect breast arterial calcification, that merits her then going to see a cardiologist to do the EKG and the stress test and get on any medications needed. We just added years of life to that woman by that early detection. So to your point, it's not behind the eight ball where, you know, assuming no heart attack has happened, but you go to a doctor for some discomfort and they're like, hey, you got a problem. This has been developing for years. To get that early, that's going to impact countless lives and improve women's health significantly at a global level.
Tell me about the structures of your company. Are they public, private? I know you have a board, so I know you got people harping on you for this or that. And I imagine you bring a board on when it's not all of your money. You got people that want to be talking and watching and things like that. How are the companies set up, basically? Who owns them and that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. So we are not public. While we did get some interest before the stock market melted down and had some talk with bankers and others, we're still private. We're a startup, right? And startups, some are small, some are very large, but we're private. Each one is its own Delaware C Corp. So we started CureMetrics first when we met the scientists out of UC San Diego that literally rocket scientists had done work for NASA, for Los Alamos, helping detect anomalies in space weather to the tune of 99% accuracy to reposition satellites that no one else could do. And so they came to us. We have our small venture fund, Analytics Ventures, and they had come to us. No business plan, no business model. Just said, hey, we're these AI machine learning experts. Anywhere you can use it to make a prediction, a recommendation, a forecast, or detect anomalies that don't belong, whether in data or images, there's an opportunity, right, to bring efficiencies, increase revenues. And that's where we said, look, we're in San Diego. It's a defense town. It's a healthcare town. What can we do in the interest of time in healthcare? And that's where we said, hey, can you detect breast cancer better than existing computer-assisted detection technologies? And they very confidently said, yeah, we can do that. And we personally co-founded then CureMetrics. And that was the beginning on that front. And then my business partner, Blaise Marley, dear friend and business partner that then developed cancer himself. And I'm happy to say he's cancer-free because of combination therapies. But because of that, we met Dr. Kurzrock. At the time, she was at the Moores Cancer Center. She's now at Wisconsin. But when she was in San Diego, the Moores Cancer Center, amazing work she was doing. And so that's where we said, Dr. Kurzrock, have you thought of starting a company so we can scale with technology and marry your oncologist's background and domain expertise with our artificial intelligence team and expertise, and let's get this out to the world because you're one person at the end of the day and can only see so many patients a day, right? And so that was the beginning of CureMatch. And so we have these two separate companies that we've co-founded and driving them together in a sense because we are fighting cancer on both sides.
Is that common where you've got people that have kind of this skill or maybe new technique, but maybe they're not ready to do their own business? They're just like, hey, yeah, we've got the product in quotes. is that common that they would go to venture firms and ask to kind of make those come together in a company? Or is it more typical that a company is going to come to a venture firm and want to do that? How unrare is that, that somebody would come with this skill and then you would not just go from the venture company, but to actually opening up your own company?
Let's peel back the layers of the onion, as they say there. There's a lot there coming from both sides. You have the traditional guy or gal from Google or Facebook or Intel or elsewhere has an idea, or they get laid off and that finally pushes them to do something on their own. And right now there's been a lot of layoffs in tech. And this is, in a sense, good for innovation because people get comfortable. They have the day job. They get paid great by these companies and they have families and college tuition and obligations. Hard to walk away from that, right? But then sometimes someone's hand is forced and they end up then being in a position saying, okay, I could either go apply for another job or I've had this idea. Let me work on this, right? So you have then companies that start and they put their own skin in the game if they can, or if they can't, they go raise money. And of course, if someone truly believes in something, they wait as long as possible to raise capital because the farther along you are, the better terms you'll get, right? But then you have situations where someone's, you know, Dr. Kurzrock was never going to stop caring for her patients to start a company. And in fact, if someone's truly a fantastic doctor and oncologist in this case, that's what they should be doing, is taking care of their patients, right? And doing research and new innovation. And so that's where we said, no, don't quit your job. Keep taking care of cancer patients. Keep doing the incredible research you're doing. But let's start this company together and let's get it out there. So we then, of course, put our money in, as in put our risk in, put our time in, and then raise money around that. Now, this venture studio model, as it's called, we didn't invent it. It's been around for quite some time, whether the name was put to it or not. But it happens more and more, especially in the healthcare side or the life science side, where let's say there's VC firms like Domain Associates out of Boston or Avalon Ventures out of here in San Diego, where they'll go into and look at the IP, look at the technology being developed at the labs at UC San Diego or Stanford or MIT or elsewhere, and license that to develop a new drug, let's say, right? And so it does happen more and more, and you do have VCs that end up jumping in as operators, and you have operators that end up becoming VCs or private equity execs. And I think it makes you a better investor to have that operational background. And I think it makes you a better operator to have that investment background to know what will resonate better and how to position and build as the company matures. We see it both ways, right? There's people that start the company first and then go down the traditional path of raising a seed round, a series A round, series B, and so forth. And there increasingly is more and more companies that are started under this venture studio model with the institution, with the individuals, and licensing a technology, let's say, in that example.
It's probably not a fair question, because right now, you might say things differently. Here's a question. Before these medical companies came along, what was your goal with the venture? I can't ask you that now because you don't want to say, oh, I want to get these things off my plate. These are a pain in the ass and I want to do something else. But let me go back 10 years. What was your goal at that point?
That's a great question, Mike. So I think we all grow and mature, and some people, maybe they know their career path from day one, and hats off to them and kudos to them. And many of us, you zig and you zag, right?
Yep.
And so in my case, if you asked me 10 years ago, I would say we had started our small VC fund and would like to grow that and invest in existing companies and then raise a fund 2 and 3 and 4. And if we're successful, of course, and identify great technologies and entrepreneurs and invest in them and also then drive a good return for our investors, right? That's what I would have said. Now, we ended up literally co-founding CureMatch and CureMetrics because we saw an opportunity. But for us, these companies would never exist, right? And so we saw an opportunity, and it did kind of pull at my personal passion around healthcare, and my family, my wife's family, all doctors were, I joke that we're the two that went to the dark side of finance and the law, but it's always been a passion of mine. And frankly, it's easier to get up every morning when you're doing something that's going to help people live longer, as opposed to walk your dog app or a sales enablement app or a digital, let's say, advertising technology, which all those are great. But for me personally, what gets me up every morning right now is what we're doing to fight cancer and heart disease. And I feel like that's my, this is what I, not to get all philosophical about it, but I almost feel like this is what I was meant to do. And so I'll drive these companies until I'm not needed, whether a bigger company acquires us, whether we go public and I step out when I'm not needed, but that'll be a good problem to have.
Your law degree, whenever I thought of maybe getting a different degree besides pharmacy, I always thought of law, and here's why. It seems that a lot of the bullies in the business world are attorneys. Those are the ones that always seem to have that last threat, like, well, you just wait because I'm an attorney and I'm going to find a way to screw you. And I would sometimes want to get a degree in that, and politics, let's say, a lot of attorneys in politics. I'd want to get a degree sometime because you've seen that in political discourses when you're watching one of the congressional hearings or something like that. Yep. And the two people, it seems like they can tell people to stick it, are MDs and attorneys, because they'll use the reasoning, which isn't always fair, but of a higher authority. It's like, well, are you, sir, a medical doctor as I am? Yeah. Or are you an attorney as I am? And right. Both of those are like shove it degrees. Do you get that? Do you ever have people that want to kind of face up to you? And because you have the degree, you're able to say, no, you're not going to try to out degree me.
Yeah, it's funny, Mike. I've never heard it put that way. Shove it degrees. I like that. I think the way I'm just thinking out loud here, we live in a country that, you know, the rule of law, right? And yes, sometimes it could be a pain and it could be, it's litigious, but you know what? It's what has made the United States what it is today, right? And where rights can be addressed. Now, sure, are there bad actors? Of course, like in any field, there are bad actors that give a certain profession a bad name, right? Whether that's doctors, that's attorneys, that's a mechanic, a dentist, right? There's bad actors. In regards to the having a law degree, there's more people with JDs, the degree, right, in the US that don't practice law versus those that do.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I'm one of those. I have a JD, but I'm not practicing law. And it gave me a great background. And when I was younger, when I didn't have all this gray hair, I know your listeners are just listening, but before I had the gray hair, the JD got me some credibility, right, as I'm developing whatever I was doing or doors I was trying to open. And when I meet someone that's gone through law school, I don't care if that's a tier one law school or a two or three, but if they've finished law school, to me, it says they have follow through. They have work ethic, because law school is a pain. It's a lot of work. And so if they finish it, I know they can follow through. And it also alters the way you think about things. And so I think that's the value in the degree. Now, if I can go back to the year 2000 when I started law school and know that what I do now, and if I knew I can get to where I am now without going to law school, I may not have gone, I'll be frank with you, because I'm not practicing law, right? So if I knew I can get to where I am without it, I wouldn't have gone through the torture of law school. But I'm proud of having it. That said, I'm probably sliding doors, would probably not be where I am, but for that. But if someone asks, should I go to law school? I go, first off, don't romanticize it, right? If I'm talking to students at a college, and it's not cheap. There's a lot of student loans, and there's a lot of lawyers that don't make much money either, right? It's certainly not, you got a law degree and you're going to financially do great. I'm proud of having the background, and it changes the way you think, but it's certainly not for everyone. So I would say to anyone considering going for their JD and going to law school, it's a huge time investment and financial investment.
I was talking to a guest last week, and we were talking about colleges too. And typically, that's always been my response and the same response to my children, saying, look, guys, this is going to show that you're able to set a goal and make it, and you can figure out how to live in a dorm by yourself and how to do this and how to do that. And that's because there was really no good communication. There wasn't another great way to do that, let's say 10 years ago. That really put a stamp on someone that said, you've got the drive to do that. And I think about now, there's different things now, like Google's got this 6-month degree. And I think of this program that we use at the pharmacy for scheduling, so on. I think there's things that are going to be metrics to show people have dedication without having to spend $100,000, $200,000 on something. When the colleges lose that, putting a mark on people, and there's other ways to mark that on people, you wonder what's going to happen to the college stuff.
And I think that the 4-year college traditional program is not for everyone. And there's now other courses and professional licenses that someone could get. There's AFACR too. There's the colleges keep raising their tuitions every year. And then the burden of student debt is something that has to seriously be considered if someone's going to go to college. And are they going to be able to pay that off with a degree? Like, if you're going to get a degree in underwater basket weaving, I don't think you're going to pay that degree off, right? Or that student debt off. If you're going to go down and become a pharmacist or a doctor or engineer, well, you're probably going to pay that debt off, right? And so I think it's important to, as parents, I have kids, and we tell them, well, it's important to factor all this in. That said, as a country, I think we are at risk because folks in other countries put more emphasis on the STEM, right? The science, technology, engineering, math programs. In the U.S., parents complain because Susie had too much homework. And in China and Russia and Eastern Europe and Israel and Iran and India, they're not complaining. In fact, they know that education is their path to, you know, either leave the country because it's unstable wherever the country is, or be successful in their own country, stable. And the fact is, there are a ton of women from those countries that are scientists and engineers. And in fact, our team, CureMatch and CureMetrics, it's like the United Nations, people from all over the world, and half of them are women. Now, and again, because science and math are emphasized, and there's no reason that one should say boys are better at it than girls. That's ridiculous. But we need to change how we think in the U.S. and in some ways, and not complain about more homework for kids, and also to emphasize the sciences and make that as attractive as getting a communications degree. And by the way, AI is probably going to replace marketing jobs and communication jobs more so than a pharmacist job or a doctor's or an engineer's or a lawyer.
You and I growing up, you know, watching the Jetsons and things like that, you always thought that computers were going to take from the bottom. They were going to be the hamburger flippers and automatic garbage collection. You were thinking of this from the bottom up. Quickly, a slap in the face from ChatGPT. I mean, people's minds go crazy here. We realize that it's from the top down. And unfortunately, throw pharmacists and doctors and everybody in there. And all of a sudden, it's like the white collars are waking up and saying, whoa, this came from the wrong end.
Absolutely. And there's certain jobs that are going to be replaced. And there's jobs that are going to be created, though, that we can't fathom, right? So you have the folks when the automobile was invented that said, what's going to happen to the people that take care of the horses and the horse buggies and carriages? They're going to lose their jobs. And yes, they did lose their jobs. But look at all the jobs that were created because of the automobile, whether it was to build it, the mechanics to take care of it, all the jobs that came and that were not foreseen, right? And on top of that, there's AI is evil. No, it's a technology. It's not good or evil. It's how is it used? The automobile has killed tens of millions of people for car accidents and maimed tens of millions of people at a global level, but it has brought more good to us as a civilization, as a society. And so the car, it's not good or evil. It's a technology, right? And so I think that's where with AI and in healthcare, yes, some jobs may be replaced, but again, we have a shortage of healthcare professionals from the doctors to the lab techs. So, you know, it's going to be a technology to empower them to take care of their patients better. So I'll give you an example on the CureMetrics side in detecting breast cancer. By law, the radiologist has to look at every single mammogram. There's a huge burnout amongst radiologists. And as one of our radiologist investors said, when he sits in front of a screen and he's going to look at mammograms for the next 4 hours, he wants to get the suspicious cases first thing, not toward the end. And so that's where our first of its kind FDA-cleared product, CM Triage, on the CureMetrics side, it batches the mammograms into suspicious and not suspicious. So this batch, nothing suspicious detected. Look at these mammograms when you have time. Get it to your junior radiologist. Read them at your convenience. This other batch, anomalies detected, get to these women ASAP, read these mammograms ASAP. And so just there, that workflow tool is a huge benefit to the radiologists and the patients that are going to have their cancer diagnosed faster. Again, we have a shortage of mammographers, right? So this technology can also turn your general radiologist into a mammographer. And you have then a junior radiologist that using technology can be as good as a senior radiologist.
When I think about AI, I'm thinking, let the AI be the new calculator. Let it do that. And let's start really looking at the metrics of life expectancy and things like that.
I love that you said that, Mike. And it's interesting you said calculator. An analogy I've used before is to say CureMatch is like Excel for oncologists, right? Excel didn't replace your CPA or my CPA. If anything, there's more CPAs, right? But it's a tool they use to process information to do their job faster and more efficiently. And so that's what we do at CureMatch is we are a tool to empower the doctor to deliver better care. It's just one tool in their toolbox that there's other tools as well, right? And so that's where AI helps process more information that, again, is beyond human cognition and to detect better, to treat better, and to monitor better. Now, what's also worth discussing is we have a CureMatch, our clinical trial intelligence platform, for the pharma companies to help get drugs to market faster. In oncology, it's about $1 billion in 10 years to get a drug to market. And by the way, it's sad, but true that they only need a 20% efficacy on that trial to get the drug cleared, meaning it's when it's cleared, it's going to be have a good response for 20% of the patients and the other 80% have minimal response. And in some cases, as we know, toxic response as well, right? And so that's where our clinical trial intelligence platform, we can go in and it's all public information, right? So you can look it up on trials.gov, right? Pfizer has 23 oncology trials going. So we can help in saying, give us the NGS panel of the cohort of patients you're considering for a trial. And we'll tell you based on just the PDF you send us, right? Of those potential clinical trial patients, we'll say this arm will have a toxic response that you don't want them in your trial. It'll kill if not delay your trial. This other arm, they'll have a much better response, better efficacy. You want patients like that as you're doing your preclinical trial setup, let's say. And so everyone wins. At the end of the day, you got to follow the money. The pharma company is going to spend less on trials and it's going to unlock their IP faster and start making money faster as they can sell the drugs. The patients benefit because the drugs will get to market fast. And so that's where in following the money, the two deepest pockets in healthcare are the pharma companies and the payers, the insurance companies. And so if you could help them make money or if you could help them save money, then ultimately that's what's going to drive getting these technologies to market. And it's frustrating. It's maddening for me and many others in the industry that these technologies don't get out there because we all have loved ones or friends that end up having cancer or other disease and they have to just work the system, right? And it's not as healthcare is just a different animal. But that's where, again, artificial intelligence can be used to process more information, not to replace, but to empower. And at the end of the day, an AI algorithm doesn't need a coffee break. It doesn't have food coma after lunch. It doesn't get distracted, right? And so if you use that technology to, let's say, detect breast cancer faster, better, more accurately, if you help in recommending best treatment potentials, combinations, it's not replacing, it's empowering.
Just messing around with ChatGPT and kind of analogy to this is, let's say I do this podcast and I have to make show notes. In the past, I would listen to the show and I think, okay, here's what Naveed said, and I'm going to maybe call it this. And it's like, let me get something out on paper so I can complete this. Now, with the ChatGPT, now you throw that in there, but when it comes out instantaneously, then you can say, I don't like the tone of this. I think we should have gone this route. You can take a standard that before took me an hour to do, and now it takes 60 seconds and you can spend that hour asking questions. Do you want it poetic? Do you want it a mandate? There's a lot of things you can do. And like you say, there's a limited amount of healthcare professionals out there and they're getting burned out just because their fingers are tired hitting the enter key or something like that. And we've got to accept that and move up to the next level, it seems.
Absolutely, Mike. And the fact is that if we can automate the redundant tasks,
the boring tasks,
then the human creativity can be unlocked and spent on other things, right? And in any industry, right? And so that's absolutely relevant here in healthcare. If a doctor can, whether it's to take care of more patients than without using a certain technology, or whether it's now a lab tech, let's say there's a technology out there that, you know, a lab tech can use it to look at EKGs. And so then it doesn't need, it's not as much of a burden on the cardiologist, right? And so guess what? Lab techs cost less than a cardiologist, right? And so that reduces the spend in the healthcare system. But yeah, by the way, it's not taking any business away from the cardiologist because they got plenty of other stuff to do.
I imagine that the word AI now is kind of a hip term. And I think I've even seen companies that have like switched their name in the last like few weeks because they want to take up on the trend. Do you look at companies that come out and say, well, that's not AI, that's a calculator they're using for that? Yeah. I mean, is there a definition, or can pretty much anybody who say that they're using a computer that brings out more than they put in, then it's AI?
It's a completely overused term, and it's become a marketing play. And a lot of technologies, again, with the investor hat on, you know, we see countless pitch decks and investor decks, and a lot of them are just glorified business intelligence, right? That's all it is. It's some business analytics tool. It's not any real neural network or machine learning or natural language processing or what we do at CureMatch. KR AI is so unique. It's not something that many folks can do. I mean, it was years ago, I think a New York Times article that said in the world, at a global level, there was only like 10,000 or 20,000, I forgot the number, of true data scientists, right? And so I'm sure it's more now, but the fact is artificial intelligence, it's been around for decades, but it's came into the limelight and then it went away. And I think the reason the last, call it 10 years, it's only accelerating and we're only hearing about it more and more, it's because of some convergence of technologies. One, there's more data to process. So whether it's the iWatch we all wear or our iPhones or other Internet of Thing devices, IoT devices, if you drive a Tesla as an IoT device, right? It's connected to the internet. And as engineers say, there are more nodes, a node being anything that's connected to the internet. It could be your iPad, it could be your phone, a laptop, it could be a medical device that's connected to the internet, a pacemaker. All these are nodes, and they're all generating so much data. So there's just more data to process. And it's, again, a human can't do it without then some tools, right? And so you have more data, you have higher compute capacity, so you have more powerful computers to process that data. You have the cloud. So by being on the cloud, it vastly reduces the cost. So if we're 100% cloud-based. And so if you gave me 20 million mammograms tomorrow, we could process it no problem because we just ramp up on AWS. Whereas before the cloud, you'd have to have the physical hardware in your office, right? The servers. And if you got 20 million mammograms, you're like, oh my God, well, it's going to take months, if not years. And tens of millions of dollars to buy those servers to process, right? And so you have more data, you have higher compute capacity, and you have the cloud. And so I think this convergence is then allowing more data to process, to train the algorithms. And so that's where then innovations are accelerated.
You said the word there, it keeps training the algorithm. Is that the definition? Is there a solid definition?
Well, there's different definitions of artificial intelligence, but essentially machine learning is you feed it, let's say, images, right? And so you say, this is a dog, this is a cat, like this is a German shepherd, this is a golden retriever. And you, the more data you feed it, the better it gets at detecting it, right? And so that's where there's like a dozen types of breast cancer. So we fed our algorithms images of different cancers from a heterogeneous data set, by the way. So meaning mammograms from women of all ethnic backgrounds. And so that now it can be useful, whether it's a Caucasian woman, an Asian American woman, an African American woman, a woman in Brazil, and right, in dense breast tissue versus not dense tissue. It's much harder to detect breast cancer in dense tissue. And so you train it, and the more data you have, the better it gets. Now, what's interesting is that there's that consensus now that data is the 21st century's oil. But data is oil is Venezuela has more oil than any country in the world, more than Saudi Arabia. But the country's falling apart because they can't get their act together to get the oil out of the ground, refine it, and turn it into gasoline. And so that's the same thing with data. You could be sitting on a pile of data. You could be the Venezuela of data, and it's useless unless you can get that data out of the ground. I say you have a scientist, and then curate the data, clean the data. And by that, I mean, everything has to be like kind. So if you have if you're training an algorithm to detect and learn to see this patient that just came into the ER is going to have a heart attack or is going to develop sepsis or going to happen, you need to feed all like-kind information, whether it's the patient's weight, their height that's collected, their age, their blood work. All of it has to be collected exactly the same for all the patients that are used to train the algorithm, or it won't be accurate or as accurate. And so that's what I mean by cleaning the data. And then at some point, though, with machine learning, there is a diminishing rate of return. If we're 98% accurate in detecting breast cancer and you said, here's 10 million more mammograms, do you want it? Of course, we'll take it. But how much better are you going to get once you're at a certain level of accuracy, right? Whereas on what we do at CureMatch with our KR AI, it's knowledge representation and reasoning. And the reason machine learning doesn't work is not optimal for best combination treatments because back to earlier in our conversation, no two cancers are ever the same. So it's impossible to use machine learning to train to get the optimal outcome because you need it to be the same to train the algorithm, right? And so if a cancer is an N of one, there's no lung cancer patient that their molecular makeup of their cancer is the same as any other cancer in the world. And so it takes that knowledge representation and reasoning AI, which takes that domain expertise, and then the input is the next gen sequencing of that patient's specific cancer. Hmm. And then the algorithm will ingest that. And based on our database, it's always being curated, recommend the top 3-drug, 2-drug, 1-drug combos in that patient's specific case. The analogy I'll use there is it's like GPS that uses KRR AI, right? If you and I were in the same city, and 1 second after each other, we're going to map how to get to the airport.
Yeah.
We wouldn't get the exact same results because traffic patterns are always changing.
With the breast tissue we were talking about, yeah, that you can duplicate more, but the other one you can't because it's individual genetics.
Exactly. It's individual based on that person's specific cancer. And a lot of oncologists increasingly are saying that cancer should not be identified by the organ of the body it's found in. There really is no lung cancer or breast or brain or stomach. It should be identified by the molecular makeup of the cancer, right? And so that's where like Merck's Keytruda drug was initially for lung cancer. And we found out years ago that it kept popping up in our reports for stomach cancer, for example. And in the case, it was a former Vietnam vet. He lived in the Central Coast here in California by San Luis Obispo. And I forgot how he found us. It was literally on his deathbed, 2-3 weeks to live. He'd done a Foundation Medicine next gen sequencing report, so he had that. And so we used that as our input again, and we cure matched him, and we got that report to the doctor. And one of the drugs recommended in this 3-drug combination was Merck's Keytruda drug. And The doctor said, I would have never thought of that because Keytruda was meant for lung cancer. And so this patient ultimately did pass, but he lived another 9 months. And we got a letter from his family. Thank you for 9 more months with the grandkids and sunsets of the Central Coast here. And so for us, that's what drives us to know that he ultimately passed, but he lived longer than he would have, but for us.
Navid, your week, if you could break it down as your role now as being involved with these three companies, break down percentage somewhat. Is it 20% thinking of fundraising? Is it 10% thinking of marketing? Is it 20% meeting with so-and-so? What does your week look like?
That's a great question. And we've done a few podcasts here and there, but I haven't been asked that one. So I always like getting a new question. So the fact is, no one day is the same. For example, today, before I got on this podcast with you, which helps us get the word out there and helps people know about us, right? We had a weekly team call, right? And then afterwards, I'll have a Zoom with our CFO, and I'll have a meeting with a potential partner, and I'll have a meeting with a potential investor or our bankers, right? So it varies day to day. I think I'm not a micromanager, and what I look to do is to find people that are better at me at everything. And I think that's part of the job of a CEO is find someone that's better at you than sales, better at you in marketing. Certainly on our side, I'm not a data scientist. So someone better in that is someone that's better clinician, right? And so you put the best, you get the best people on the bus and they'll drive it in the right direction. And so I don't micromanage, especially in this post-COVID environment where we have an office, but we also work remote, so we're hybrid. And so we have a developer in Oklahoma City, and we got a marketing guy in Portland, Oregon, and a regulatory expert in Chicago, right? And so that's where we truly made lemonade out of lemons in this new environment. And you have to trust and empower these people to do their job. And of course, there's milestones, and it's you, if someone doesn't meet them, you see it, whether you're in office or not. But I think that's where I look to find people that I can then empower and where we need them to do for the company, and also have them have ownership and pride in the company. And ownership, of course, comes in options, and you want people to, everyone's incentivized, right? Not only to get paid, but to have a vested interest in the success of the company. At the end of the day, no one goes to a startup for the cash compensation. Of course, you got to pay them a competitive salary, but you can go to a big company and get paid more. And so it takes a certain, for some people, they're big company people, and others, they hate big companies and they want to be entrepreneurial and part of a startup and have more responsibilities. And so that's where my day varies, but it's some combination thereof of internal team meetings, marketing efforts, and corporate communication efforts to get the word out there, meeting with new potential oncologists or radiologists to make them aware of what we do. And so every day varies, which keeps me excited every year.
If somebody on your team wasn't a good fit for the company, why would that be? Would it be that they lost focus? They were maybe hired wrong? They're just lazy? If you could think of somebody who would not be a good fit, what would you have been thinking previously? And then what's the matter now?
So there's a reason there's a saying, hire slow, fire fast.
Yeah, right.
And advice is always easier given than taken. But that, the older I get, the more, you know, that resonates with me. It's so true. Hire slow and fire fast. Because if you have the wrong person inside an organization, it's literally like a cancer that can grow and metastasize and spread, right? And so when we got Ali Perlina to join us as chief science officer, excellent addition to the team. She was at Human Longevity Inc. to work with Craig Vender, who first human genome mapped. She developed the oncology division that NeoGenomics then purchased in 2020, went on to Viome, the microbiome company that helped that scale. And then we were able to get her to join us in 2020. And good people follow good people. So we have people on our team that worked with her at Human Longevity Inc., then had followed her to Viome, and now here at CureMatch. So that's on the positive side, getting someone in, and she's passionate and she's driven and she has a purpose, and there's no 9 to 5, right? It's, she's not a clock watcher when clock in at 9 and clock out at 5 p.m. And you certainly have those people that, oh, weekends are my time and work-life balance. I don't believe in work-life balance. If you're truly trying to do something fast and for better or for worse, and I'll check my email on the weekend or Slack or text, and again, that's, you have to find your personal balance with the family obligations and other things. But there's those that are just so driven and passionate that they can't stop thinking and doing, right? And then you have the others that literally, other types of people that, you know, no, they're not going to reply to that email over the weekend or that Slack. And there's, again, pros and cons, and people have different opinions on that. But then there's people that are toxic too. And so even in a remote environment, if someone creates a toxic environment, let's say on Slack or on a Zoom, that still has an impact. So I think it's really important for the leadership at a company to be aware of that. Just because we're in a remote environment doesn't mean there can't be a toxic work culture. And so we're really mindful of that. And at the end of the day, we have a no assholes rule, right? So if someone's an ass and or someone's difficult to work with, and they're not going to be a fit. And I put a lot of emphasis on treat others as you want to be treated.
When I was younger, I always looked up to, we all did, we looked up to adults and we thought they had all their stuff together just because they were older. And I think sometimes when people look at tech companies, for example, they might think that people are easier to get along with than you would at a local burger joint where you got high school kids and they're working and so on. But people are people, you know.
People are people.
All kind of different organizations, and you get people that are assholes wherever you go.
Yeah, I didn't invent this saying, but I believe in it. That you could tell, or you could tell a lot about someone by how they treat someone at a restaurant, a server, right? And it's like, it's not that difficult to mind your pleases and your thank yous, right? And they're serving you food, and don't be an ass, right? And so that's a personality trait. It doesn't matter if they got 50 degrees behind their name or if they never made it to college, right? And so I think that's just in any industry, to your point, whether it's a burger joint or a biotech or a software company, people are people. And that's why when you put the right people together, like magic happens, right? You get the right people on a team. They respect each other. They like working with each other. They believe in the mission, the purpose of the company. And then you're more successful. You help more people, whether it's in healthcare or in an ad tech company, right? You're going to be more impactful. And at the end of the day, we're doing good, but it's not illegal to make money either, right? And I think that's where you do good, especially in healthcare, and the money will follow.
What's your favorite hour of the week and your worst hour of the week? And so the favorite might be, oh, I really like meeting with my CFO. And the worst might be that you got to do this that week. What are those bookends?
So let me rephrase that to not hour, but day. So I love getting the week going on Mondays because I'm excited about what is upcoming for the week. So I know some people hate Mondays because they got to go to school or go to work. I love Mondays. On the same token, as much as I love my weekend and I can't wait to spend time with my wife and my kids and see friends and do non-work stuff on the weekend, sometimes I get, and I've talked to other people about this, I get Friday afternoon work anxiety, right? Where I love Fridays. I'm not going to say I don't like Fridays, but I love Fridays, but I'll catch myself because I'm like, let me send one more email. Let me make one more phone call. Let me go through one more spreadsheet, right? And the fact is I have to talk to myself to say doing that at 4 p.m. on a Friday is not, it's probably nothing that can't wait in some cases, right? And especially if someone, let's say we're on the West Coast, if not on the East Coast, 3 hours ahead, it's 7 p.m. on a Friday night in New York or Atlanta, Georgia. And so like, don't bother sending that email right now, right? And so I can't say best hour or worst hour, but I'd say I look forward to Mondays and sometimes I do get work anxiety at the end of a Friday because again, I'm so excited about what we're doing.
It's a good sign. Most of the people in the U.S. are the opposite of that.
I'm not a religious person, but I use the word blessed. I feel blessed to do what I'm doing.
Navi, tell us one more time. I know that we mentioned the companies and I'll put a link to this in the show notes, but what's a good place for them to get the basics of what we talked about today about your company?
Sure. No, thanks for asking, Mike. And so if anyone goes to AIMedGlobal.com, it will drive them to the links for CureMetrics.com or CureMatch.com, whichever one interests them, or they can just go directly to CureMatch.com or CureMetrics, M-E-T-R-I-X.com.
Navid, I appreciate what you're doing. Thanks for your time and thanks for sharing that with us. It's exciting stuff.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. And again, thank you for helping us get the word out.
Very good, Navid. We'll keep in touch. Thanks again.
Take care. Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.